You're listening to Economics Amplified, the latest thinking on the biggest issues from UChicago's Becker Friedman Institute.
It's my pleasure to introduce my longtime friend and colleague, Eric Hurst, who's giving the first Brown Bag of the Year. Eric has been at Booth since 1999 when he graduated from the University of Michigan. And I would say that he has done just about everything that anyone ever could have asked from him over that time. In addition to having an amazing record of research productivity, he has won not one but two Booth Teaching Awards. And he'll talk about his research, but I just want to say a short mention of what I think makes Eric's research so special. Some of you might know that I am stridently anti-macroeconomics, that there's a big division in economics between macroeconomics and microeconomics. And I just think that macroeconomics has more or less lost its way over the last 20 years. Now, one of the hardest things to do when you're an academic economist is to have a foot in two different camps, to be able to contribute in one area while being really part of another. And that's what Eric has managed. What Eric has managed to do is bring just a little tiny dose of sanity to what is the insanity that has been macroeconomics for the last 20 years. So how does Eric do that? He's probably going to say all this is wrong when he gets up and talks. But how Eric does it is, instead of thinking about big global issues that we don't understand very well, and probably will never understand, he looks at the individual behaviors of everyday people, what they consume, how they spend their leisure, and then he builds up from that, from these first principles, into conclusions about what we can understand about how the real macroeconomy works. And I think that's an approach that not very many people are taking. It really hasn't been that much in style, but through really, I think, the work of Eric and just a few others, like Chad Searson, he's sort of transforming the way that that economists think about the best way to study the macroeconomy. So on that note, Eric, the floor is yours.
It's going to be depressing. I'm going to talk to you today about non-employment. Unemployment is one component of non-employment in the U.S. Since 1999, 2000, about 80% of prime-age individuals worked. Okay, so it's a good number. Between 2000 and 2011, that number has fallen to about 73%. So this is what this picture is showing you now. It's the fraction of people who are not working, anchoring 2000 at zero, and that's gone up by about 8 percentage points over this time period. You hear this in the newspapers all the time. Why aren't people working? Okay, so this is kind of a big focus. There's been tremendous amount of stories put forth by many people, academics and policymakers, trying to explain this phenomenon. Okay, if we could only spend more as a government, we might be able to put people back to work. If we could only reduce people's debt burden, we might be able to put people back to work. If only we could reduce uncertainty in the economy, we might be able to put people back to work. And these are stories that people have been telling. I'm going to try to tell a different story today. And the story that I'm going to tell, I'm going to try to back up with some data. And that story is going to be less amenable to the certain types of policies that policymakers have been talking about, both Republican and Democrat, about stimulating job growth in the U.S., at least in the short run. So what am I going to do? So I'm going to talk about two phenomenon that hit the U.S. economy during the 2000s, one of which is going to be the most important part of my talk, which is this large, dramatic decline in manufacturing that occurred in the United States much prior to the recession. Okay, I'm going to talk to you about this. And I'm going to talk to you about when manufacturing jobs go away, the demand for labor for low-skilled workers falls, their wages fall, and some workers exit the labor force. And I'm going to show you what is going on in this 2000s period, prior to and continuing through the recession, is an adjustment of workers to the decline in manufacturing that hit the U.S. Then I'm going to talk to you about something else that occurred during the 2000s that might have, and I'm going to use this word masked, might have blurred our vision about what was happening to the aggregate labor market in the 2000s, in the boom period, such as at the same time when manufacturing jobs were going away, potentially in a permanent way, because manufacturing jobs tend to decline and they don't tend to come back, okay, or at least haven't historically, there was a temporary housing boom that absorbed some workers. And as a result, the aggregate labor market during the boom years looked a lot better than we thought it would have been. And then when the housing bust came along, all those jobs went away and we're still left with a decline in manufacturing. And what I'm going to try to do is quantify those mechanisms and try to see how much that contributed to non-employment over this time period. Let me just show you a picture. And this is when I was starting this project. The magnitude of this picture struck me. So what this is the number of manufacturing jobs in the United States starting in the late 70s through today. And we've heard about the dramatic decline in U.S. manufacturing occurring for 30 years. Between the early 1980s and the late 1990s, we lost about 1.5 million manufacturing jobs. That was the big manufacturing decline that the U.S. economy was experiencing during this time period. 1.5 million jobs were disappearing from manufacturing during the 80s and 90s. Between 2000 and 2007, prior to the recession, okay, well before we started going into this global decline, manufacturing jobs in the United States disappeared by about 4 million of them. That is a huge chunk by historical standards. So not only was manufacturing declining, the amount of jobs being lost in manufacturing was really large over a short amount of period. Now, they continued declining in the recession. That purple year is the pre-recession period. Okay? After the recession, they continued to decline. And when they talk about the rebound in manufacturing that you might hear about in the newspapers and CNN, manufacturing jobs bounce back up, that's from the trough to the star. That's how much things have bounced back. Well below where we were at the beginning of the recession and orders of magnitudes below where we were at the beginning of the decade. Now, let me just say one other thing. Historically, and I already told you this, and this is going to be the essence of this paper. Historically, a decline in manufacturing is associated with a decline in the demand for low-skilled workers, a reduction in wages for low-skilled workers, and an exit from the labor force from low-skilled workers. And then I'm going to give you a little framework to think about in about 4 or 5 slides. What I want you to think about is people just moving up and down their labor supply curve. So the people who've had my class before, you know what I'm talking about. The people who haven't had my class yet, I'm sorry, you hopefully will. And then I'm going to talk to you about moving up and down labor supply curves. You'll get some of this in your micro classes as well. And that's the mechanism that I'm going to be trying to exploit today. So here's the findings of this paper, and then I'll tell you a little bit of how I'm going to do this, show you some data, and then we'll take some questions at the end. So these structural shifts, this decline in manufacturing, could explain about 40% of the increase in non-employment in the U.S. between 2000 and 2011. Okay? Much of this occurred prior to the recession. Almost all of this effect is on the out of the labor force margin and not in the unemployment rate statistics that you see. So when we talk about the unemployment rate, those are people who aren't working but are looking for jobs. There's a big other group of people who aren't working who aren't looking for jobs, and that's where a lot of these people are ending up. During the recession itself, manufacturing declines is still contributing to some of the decline in employment during the recession, but also the housing bust is contributing to some of that as well. Okay, and that's about 35% of the decline in employment in this recession could be attributed to the continuing decline of manufacturing, the erosion of manufacturing, and the undoing of this temporary housing boom, the housing bust. A corollary of this is that the labor market was much weaker in the 2000 to 2007 period than we might have thought from the decline in manufacturing because the housing boom lifted up the labor market. So things weren't as bad in the early 2000s as they might have been otherwise had we not had this housing boom that came and went. Okay. The net effect of the housing boom and bust over the decade was close to zero. Okay, even though the housing boom lifted things during the boom period and the housing bust depressed things in employment space during the bust, the net effect of a housing boom and bust was close to zero over this decade. Okay. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit at the end, and this is going to be kind of some cool stuff. One of the ways we usually adjust to declining labor market conditions, in particular for low-skilled individuals, is to accumulate skills. And I'm going to show you that one of the things the housing boom did was deterred people from accumulating skill during the boom years. They looked around at their labor market, and it wasn't as bad as it normally would be, so they went to work as opposed to, you know, choosing to go to some college. And as a result, the adjustment from the decline in manufacturing might have been slowed down as well from this housing boom. Okay, I already talked to you about this. Let me just show you some pictures. So what this is now, just to kind of show you that this mechanism might be at play during this time period, is the share of non-college men. So these are men without a college degree, so anything less than 4 years of college, as a fraction of all men in this group who work in manufacturing or who work in construction. Okay? So other things you could work in, you could work in sales, you could work in trucking, or you cannot work at all. So that those sum of all of those will sum to 100. 35% of them in the early 1980s worked in neither manufacturing or construction. You see that the manufacturing share has been declining over time. Okay. Manufacturing jobs aren't declining, but the population is growing, so the share of people working in manufacturing over this time period kind of deteriorated slowly. And then you get into this period, and it kind of accelerates potentially a little bit, but you get this big chunk right in this period. At the same time, construction employment, which is historically relatively stable at about 10%, increased from 10% to 15% over a short amount of time. So the share of men working in manufacturing, which is declining, and construction, which is one element of the housing boom that affects people's employment, was relatively stable over this time period. So you could see there might have been some offset between the manufacturing and the construction sector during this time period. And for men, most of the effect, about 80% of the effect, is in the construction industry. So hours will go down further. So somebody, Steve's asking, why isn't this number going down to zero here? What are we building? And the answer is hours have fallen by quite a lot. So I got a brother. My older brother's a wallpaper in South Florida. Okay, if we called him up on the government surveys and says, are you working? My brother would say, yes. Now, when I talk to my brother on the phone, he's working about 3 hours a week. But again, he would be out. So hours are going to be falling more. So the employment share, again, is only one metric of labor market activity. And if we hourd weight this, you'd actually get maybe even more of a decline in construction in this time period. So hours in construction, conditional on working in construction, have fallen during this time period. For women, manufacturing share, less important, but still a big decline even for women during the boom years. Women in manufacturing fell from, 9% down to about 6%, a 3 percentage point decline over this time period. Now, women didn't have the increase in consumption or construction, but I'm going to show you even that there is other sectors that absorbed women during the housing boom that is in construction. Mortgage brokerage, other retail services. When housing prices go up, you and I spend a little more. Okay, so when we spend more, we need more local services. And those are the sectors for which the women moved into during this time period. So when people say it's all a construction story, for men, that's kind of a true statement. But for women, it's very little of the housing boom effect is on construction. Okay, last picture, and then I'm going to show you a brief kind of model to think about. And then we'll get into the data and then take some questions. So this is just wage data, again, from non-college men. Because a lot of the mechanism I'm going to talk to you about is the relationship between people moving up and down a labor supply curve because their labor demand curve is moving around. Okay? And if that story is correct, you should see some relationship between people's propensity to work and wages. And what I want you to see is that as manufacturing was declining during the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, the wages of low-skilled workers were falling during this time period. Okay? But what happened at the same time is that in the recent period, as construction demand increased, you have the decline in wages from manufacturing falling, the increase in wages from construction increasing, and the wage effect actually kind of stabilized during the housing boom during this time period. So in my data, I'm going to try to show you lots of information on both wages and employment, but I just want to show you some of the aggregate trends. Okay. So I've already told you, I have a fancy model in the paper, but I think I want to get to the empirical work so we can get questions. But the fancy model I just want to translate into things that you guys should be very familiar with, which is there's a labor supply curve. Okay. As wages fall, people face a reservation wage. Okay. The reservation wage is when wages fall below X, I stop working and I choose to do something at home. I leave the labor market, get some government transfers perhaps, become a home person. So there's some price for which people are no longer willing to work. That's the essence of a labor supply curve. Okay. When you have some labor demand shock, people might choose to then work less, puts downward pressure on wages, and people exit the labor force. Now, a lot of what the paper, the model in the paper is much more complicated than this. Why? Because you're going to have multiple sectors, a manufacturing sector, a construction sector, another sector. Whether people end up not working or not is going to depend upon what their reservation wage is, the labor supply curve, but also how substitutable their skills are between the manufacturing sector and the other sectors in the economy. So basically, if you're really endowed with manufacturing technology, you're a really good manufacturing worker, okay, and not very good construction worker, when there's a demand decline in the demand for manufacturing, you might choose then not to work as opposed to going to work in the construction industry. But if you're relatively substitutable between manufacturing and construction, then you could get absorbed by the construction industry, even if there's a decline in the demand for manufacturing. So that's kind of the model in the paper. But for you guys, what I want you to think about is just people moving up and down the labor supply curve. So what I'm going to do, how do I test this? Where do I go? How do I identify these potential mechanisms in the data? So what I'm going to exploit is regional variation in the extent to which locations received a manufacturing shock and people who received a housing boom. Okay, so that's going to be kind of the exercise in my mind. The variation that I'm going to exploit is the spatial differences in where manufacturing declines occurred and where housing booms tended to occur. So my level of space that we're going to do throughout the paper is going to be a metropolitan area. So the way you should think about it is Chicago and surrounding suburbs. Okay, so that's my area of space in this paper. Just to keep track of notation, I'm going to index space by K. L is going to be some labor market outcome in that area of space. So L is going to be whether the fraction of people working, or in this case, when I go to individual data, whether you work or not in region K. It could also be your wages in region K. It could be whether you're working or not in manufacturing or construction or some other industry in region K. So my outcome variable, this is what I'm going to try to explain, is going to be L, and it's going to be some labor market outcome. K is indexing the space, and then those fancy notation up there is basically just to say labor market outcomes in region K are going to be a function of labor demand stuff in region K and labor supply stuff in region K. Okay? Labor supply stuff, I'm just going to call that theta. Okay? In the paper, I have some assumptions about what's going on with this labor supply stuff. And then I'm going to try to measure different components of the labor demand stuff. Labor demand stuff due to manufacturing changes. Labor supply demand stuff due to potential housing market changes above and beyond manufacturing, and then everything else that affects labor demand that isn't attributable to housing or manufacturing. So that's kind of the model. It's a very simple model. How am I going to implement that? I'm going to run some regressions. Okay, I'm going to run some regressions of these labor market outcomes on those measures of demand shocks in different areas. Now, in the paper, we talk a lot of how do we get exogeneity? How do we get a causal interpretation of these manufacturing changes and these house price changes on local economic activity? So suppose we wake up in the morning and all of us in a given area just get lazy. Okay, for whatever reason, we decide not to work. And if we decide not to work, the propensity that I'm working in manufacturing is going to fall. And then I'm going to run, whether you work or not, on manufacturing declines, and then want to interpret something causal about the manufacturing declines, and that just doesn't work, right? Because the variation isn't coming from the manufacturing declines. The variation is coming from something else in the data. So how do I get around this? So what I'm going to use is a predicted manufacturing declines within a given area. Okay? Now, what does that mean? Well, the best way to describe this is take two cities. You got a city like Detroit, which is heavily endowed in manufacturing employment, and you got a city like Orlando, which is not heavily endowed in manufacturing employment. Okay? What happens is in the national labor market, I'll even make it more precise, in the labor market outside of Detroit, manufacturing employment fell. Okay? And I'm going to predict how much manufacturing employment in Detroit fell by interacting the share of their employment in manufacturing, okay, which is initially fixed at some period, 2000, and that's going to be my time period. 2000 will be when I start my data. And I'm going to interact that with the national decline in manufacturing employment between 2000 and 2007 in every area besides Detroit. And I'm going to do this over every manufacturing industry within the country in the city. Okay, so basically I'm going to look at three different digit manufacturing. So toy manufacturing is different than, you know, food processing manufacturing, which is different than shoe manufacturing. In different country, or different parts of the country, different MSAs are endowed with this initial distribution of manufacturing employment across the places. Okay, and then I'm going to interact, and we'll call that S. That's the initial share in your manufacturing industry in region K in some initial time period, and I'm going to interact that with a national decline in manufacturing employment in the country in that industry. Okay? And I'm going to sum that over all industries, and I'm going to do that for each city, and that's going to give me some predicted manufacturing decline that is not related to what actually happened in Detroit between 2000 and 2007, but is based upon some initial characteristics of Detroit in year 2000. Okay, so that's going to be my metric of this manufacturing decline. I just wanted you to show that this metric of the manufacturing decline, I'm going to show you lots of pictures that look like this, where the x-axis of these graphs are going to be the predicted decline in manufacturing in given cities. So each of the circles is a city. The size of the circle is how big the city is. Okay, smaller cities, you know, like Ames, Iowa, or something like that, is going to be really small. And then you have big cities like Los Angeles and Chicago, which are bigger circles. Okay, this is the predicted decline based upon individual shares in manufacturing in the city interacted with national trends in manufacturing over this time period. And this is the actual change in manufacturing in those cities. And what I want you to take away is the predicted manufacturing declines are highly correlated with the actual manufacturing declines over this time. Okay, and this is what my metric of the manufacturing shock is going to be, these predicted manufacturing declines. Now, I should mention something which I haven't mentioned yet, is why did manufacturing decline nationally? That's something I'm not going to take a stand on in the paper. But the stories others have told about why national manufacturing has declined do things like the rise of China, okay, and China is now more competitive with U.S. manufacturing industries than it was before. Increases in productivity in the manufacturing sector. We can now make a car with less people and more machines than we did in the past. Regardless of the source of the manufacturing declines, okay, I don't care where those are coming from. I'm saying conditional on them happening, what is the effect on labor markets? Okay. What is my measure of housing market activity? We do lots of stuff in the paper, and I'm not going to tell you all of what we do, but our first pass at the data is just to use housing prices as a proxy of housing market activity. Okay? Now, this is pros and cons of a lot of this, and again, in the paper we do lots more to try to isolate variation, a causal story of house prices on labor markets, but this gives you a first pass. Areas which had big house price increases had some increase in housing demand. Now, where that housing demand came from, whether it was some other sector booming, okay, whether it was the national reduction in interest rates in the economy that made house prices take off in some places relative to others, I'm not going to take a stand on that in the base stuff I'm going to show you today. So what I could be capturing is with house prices is any other shock that hits local labor markets that shows up in housing prices besides manufacturing. Because I'm going to purge the manufacturing change of the housing price changes. When manufacturing slumps in Detroit, people don't want to live in Detroit, and the demand for housing in Detroit goes down, so that's already going to be in there. So I'm going to take that out of the house price measure and then use the remaining variation. Okay? And I could be capturing other local demand shocks or potentially the direct effect of housing on economic activity. Like when you guys' house value goes up, you refinance, and you buy, you know, more stuff. Okay, maybe that's a channel. And when you buy more stuff, you need more shop clerks and you need more restaurateurs and things of that nature. Now, there's also the direct effect of housing increases on construction activity. When the demand for housing goes up, we also build more houses. And in the data, I want to show you two things. First, there is a positive relationship at the metropolitan level area between how much house prices went up and how much people started increasing their construction activity. So this is the share of people working in construction, the share of men working in construction. You can see there's a positive relationship. This is consistent with the variation across regions in terms of their housing activity being driven by demand differences, housing demand differences across places, and not housing supply differences across places. Positive correlation. Price and quantities are moving in the same direction. Okay. The second thing I want to show you is whatever I'm proxying for our housing prices came and went. You all know this, but it occurs at the metropolitan area as well. This is the size of the boom relative to the size of the bust in these metropolitan areas. And all the places that had big booms were followed by a big bust. So whatever was going on with the housing markets, it tended to be temporary. Prices went up by a lot and came down by a lot in a relatively short amount of time period. And this is consistent almost across all the MSAs. No places that had a big decline in housing, didn't have a big increase in housing on the upside. So this is what I got. So I'm just going to run this regression of labor market outcomes on my predicted manufacturing declines, some measure of housing market activity, and then some initial controls. Okay, where those initial controls are going to be things like, you know, the size of the city and the share of the high educated people in the city, or anything else that could you might be concerned about that makes these cities different from each other. These controls have essentially no effect on our analysis, but we throw them in just to allay people's concerns that there's nothing going weird going on in terms of the differential cities at the beginning time period. Okay. So I'm going to show you some results from these types of regressions right now, and then I'll show you how I interpret those regressions, and then we'll move on. So all my data I'm going to use is from censuses. Okay, so the U.S. Census basically in 2000 asked people, are you working? What kind of wages are you making? What industry are you working in? And some demographic variables, including what type of MSA you live in. That's in 2000. Starting in 2001, the American Community Survey started existing, which is a short census form, large amounts of population, but not 5% of the population. Smaller samples, like 200,000, 300,000 people, and tracking those same questions over time. So I'm going to use the American Community Survey for every year after 2000. My main analysis is going to be on the period 2000 to 2007. Okay. So most of the manufacturing declines from that picture occurred from 2000 to 2003 or 4, and I'm going to ask, what is the effect on labor markets from 2000 to 2007 that allows some adjustment to occur across the other sectors and potentially other places. So we'll measure mobility across places as well. Okay. But I'm also going to look at other time periods in the data as well. Particularly, I'm going to show you the long-run effects of housing booms and manufacturing declines over the decade as a whole. So let me show you some graphical results just to kind of get our feet wet of what the data looks like. Okay. So the first picture I'm going to show you is just the relationship between that manufacturing decline at the local level and the change in non-employment at the local level. Okay? So this is up means lots of people aren't working in that place in the boom period. This is 2000 to 2007, well before the recession. And the x-axis is basically how bad your manufacturing shock was. How should you read this graph? Places like Detroit that had bad manufacturing shocks had higher increases in non-employment than places like Orlando that didn't have the bad manufacturing shock during the boom period. And this relationship, you can see, your eye, I'm going to show you some regressions in a little while, but I always like to see things accurately, make sure there's no one city that's really weird that's driving all the results, and it doesn't look like it. Everything's kind of clustered around this line. There's a nice, just with no controls, no nothing, you can see this negative relationship between the size of the manufacturing decline and how much non-employment increased. Systematically across all the metropolitan areas in the United States. I've drawn this line for only those places that didn't get a housing boom. So I'm going to take all of the cities, and I'm going to take the bottom two-thirds of the cities in respect to house price changes between 2000 and 2007, and that's what I've graphed you here. Now, why did I do that? I want to see if the relationship, how the relationship looks in the places that had the housing booms. Those are going to be these triangles on this next picture. And what I want you to take away from this next picture is that almost all the triangles are below the regression line for the cities without the housing boom. So what does that say? For a place for the given manufacturing shock, if you got a housing boom, you're much less likely to work. You're less likely to have an increase in unemployment than you would be if you didn't get a housing boom. So there's two things you should be taking from these pictures. Manufacturing shocks, negative manufacturing shocks, reduced employment over this time period. Fact one. Okay, increased non-employment. Fact two, housing booms systematically boosted employment during this time period, reduced non-employment. The triangles are lower than the circles. And those are the two things that I'm going to try to estimate from the data in a regression in a second, but you can already see the patterns that are in the data. I want to show you one more figure just to get your feet wet with what I'm doing, and it's the exact same picture, but in terms of wage space. Okay. Places that had the bad manufacturing shock, over to the left on the x-axis, Detroit, had lower wage growth systematically than places that had high, or less manufacturing shocks over this time period. So wages in Detroit were growing at a lower rate than wages in Orlando systematically over this time period. And we'll put standard errors on these pictures in a few seconds. But again, when we go to the housing boom cities, the triangles are way up in the space. So places that had housing booms systematically had higher wage growth than places that didn't have a housing boom, conditional on a given manufacturing shock. So the two things from this picture you should take away is bad manufacturing shocks depressed wages. Big housing booms lifted wages during this time period. Okay? So that's kind of what the data is saying. Now I could do fancy stuff with the data. Put it in that regression, control for things, weight things by the size of the city. Ames, Iowa gets less effect on things than San Francisco. There's like four people in Ames. Anybody from Ames? There's like four people in the data from Ames. So they don't get as much weight as some of the other places. We do all of that, and you get roughly the same patterns that I showed you before. So basically, this is the coefficient on the predicted manufacturing decline. This is the coefficient on the housing boom. In places that had big housing booms, non-employment growth was lower. Okay? Employment growth was higher. In places that had big negative manufacturing declines, same thing I showed you before, those are the places that had positive non-employment growth during this time period. What I showed you in blue is some way we can interpret the coefficients. So in economics, we often run these regressions, but we care about economic magnitudes. We try to turn it into units that we could understand. So what those units are in these pictures, everything that's in the blue shaded box, is going to be, suppose we got a one standard deviation manufacturing shock. So take all the manufacturing shocks that hit all the cities and take one standard deviation of that that distribution. So it kind of gives you some meaningful type of scaled shock. So a one standard deviation manufacturing shock basically increased non-employment by about 1 percentage point. Okay? That's a big, big effect. I told you before, we were already in we were trying to explain 6 or 7 percentage points from these manufacturing, and we got one of it just from this one type of shock during this short time period, not even continuing through the recession. The housing price effect says take a one standard deviation housing price growth, and that lowered non-employment by about 1 percentage point as well. So these shocks are roughly the same magnitude. This last column, this first column, the way we're doing it, is in non-employment rate space. This is wage space. So the construction shock, or the housing shock, raised wages. The manufacturing shock lowered wages. Okay. This last column is how much of that is showing up in construction. In this picture, what I'm showing you now, I'll show you other groups in a second, is in for non-college men. Okay. And so these non-college men, about 80% of the effect of the 1 percentage point on manufacturing, or 6 percentage points out of the 9 percentage points in housing, 8 percentage points out of the 1 percentage point of the housing shock showed up in construction. Okay, so that's why I say most of the effect, 8 out of 10, showed up in construction for men. Here's all the other groups, and you can see the biggest effects were on non-college men and non-college women. For the non-college women, though, hardly any of the housing effect showed up in construction. Okay, essentially, none of it did. So there's still effect of the housing boom on women's employment, but there was in all other sectors besides construction. And you could see college women were the least responsive to any of the shocks. Why? Because they just don't work in manufacturing, and they don't work in construction that much. There's still some spillover effects, but it's relatively small in magnitude relative to the non-college men and non-college women. If I aggregate across all groups, that's that last line. A one standard deviation shock in the manufacturing reduced employment by about 0.7 percentage points during this time period. Okay. Already showed you that. In the paper, we also, I'm going to move on to some counterfactuals in a second so we can take some questions. But in the paper, we also measure migration response. Because how do you take up a local estimate and apply it nationally? Well, what happened is all the people who got hit with the shock could be moving out. So we could try to estimate who moved out, and then we could make assumptions about what those people who moved out would have done. Suppose they all remained employed, suppose they all remained non-employed, and we could use that to bound our estimates about how effective or how migration affects these results. And what we're going to find is, if anything, the migration results causes us to underestimate some of the effect of the manufacturing shock on house price, on employment activity during this time period. So let me show you. I do a lot more in the paper. Let me just show you some of the counterfactuals that we're doing. Okay. So this red line is taking those coefficients that I gave you and trying now to take the observed changes in manufacturing that occurred during those time periods and predict how much non-employment would have increased over this time period. Okay? So it takes those coefficients from those regressions I showed you, multiply it by the actual change in national manufacturing year by year, and give you a plotted, predicted effect of manufacturing employment over this time period. The blue line is the data. This is what I showed you before. This is the actual change in non-employment over this time period. Taking the red line from start to finish, and then comparing that to the blue line, start to finish, we explain about 42% of the increase in non-employment over this time period. So this is why I told you the depressing part of what was going on with the talk, is there's a trend in non-employment in the economy from the decline in manufacturing. Will that continue into the future? I don't know. But at least during this time period, manufacturing is declining, lowering the wages of low-skilled workers, and some of those lower-skilled workers are exiting the labor force. And when we look at aggregate statistics, this is where it's showing up. Okay. Do we expect this to revert relatively quickly? Probably not. Right? These are people who haven't been working at these current wages, so basically unextending the unemployment benefits, temporarily digging a hole by the government telling us to build a new bridge or something like that, will lift their employment temporarily, but as soon as that goes away, they'll go right back to the position that they were in before. There's this group of people that are not working that take some adjustments. So the normal adjustment for this group is to go get some schooling, develop some other skills, move to different areas, and those take time. And this is why I refer to this as being an increase in medium-run employment within the economy. Now you might ask yourself, why didn't we see this going on in the boom period? And the answer is, the housing boom was lifting employment during this time period. And the net effect of housing, and I didn't show you this, but we could estimate the net effect of housing over the whole decade was zero. So you're right back to where you started from. The boom increase lifted employment, and all of that employment was shed during the recession. Now, some people, including some of my colleagues in the business school, focus a lot of the decline in decline in housing on labor markets during this time period, and that's 100% correct. But what they don't talk about is that how it lifted employment during the boom period, and the net effect over the decade was relatively zero. Another way to say it, San Francisco's trend rate in unemployment over the decade, which had a big housing boom and a housing correction, was roughly the same as Des Moines over the decade that didn't have a housing boom or bust at all. The net effect of manufacturing and housing is this purple line. Okay? And you could see the effect of the manufacturing decline was tempered by about a percentage point during the boom years. So people who are measuring the employment situation in the U.S. thought things weren't as bad as they could have been otherwise because a housing boom was masking, lifting up, undoing some of the manufacturing shock that occurred. Okay. During the recession, how much of the purple line explained the change in the blue line during the recession? And that's about 35%. So of the decline in employment during the recession, some of that is due to manufacturing, the continuation of the trend. But most of it is the housing bubble undoing itself and having an effect on employment. That's about 35% of increase in non-employment over this time period. Now, where does the other two-thirds come from? I have no idea. So if you have your favorite cyclical unemployment story that we need to raise taxes or do something else to the or cut taxes or give credits or something to jumpstart the economy, I don't know where that other two-thirds are coming from. But a third of it seems to be coming from an undoing of a temporary boom in the continuing deterioration of manufacturing. Okay. I want to show you one other picture, and then we'll conclude and take some questions. You guys might have seen this and talked about for a while in the popular press. This is the propensity for women, the top line, the red line, men, the bottom line, to get at least 1 year of college attainment. Okay? The red line creeping up over time at a faster rate than the blue line. But both of them go into the period of the housing boom, and both of those lines break trend. Okay, the dotted line is the trend during the pre-recession period. Men actually start deteriorating their educational attainment during this time period. slightly. Okay, the line kind of dips a little. Women just slows down the growth rate. Now, what could be causing that? And there's been a lot of literature talking about what causes the decline in education, the propensity to get at least 1 year of college during this time period. Well, what we show using the same local labor market analysis and then regressing our shocks, our changes on the propensity for people to go to school in the local area or the state as a whole. And we could try to estimate whether the construction boom, all else equal, drew people away from some sort of college attainment during this time period. And what we find is the answer is yes. That in places that had the big housing booms, the propensity to go to college fell a lot. And then in the places that didn't have the housing boom, the propensity to go to college continued on trend. From this, we could explain about 80% of these deviations from trend from these housing booms during this time period. Essentially, all of the effect. When I say essentially, I'm just going to take that away. All of the effect was on the propensity to go to a two-year college or a trade school, and none of the effect was on four-year colleges or graduate schools. Which you can imagine, the construction boom was drawing people in who were on the margin of going to get a little bit of some sort of training, but it wasn't deterring the activities of people who are going to four-year schools or graduate schools. Okay. So this is, again, now why is this important? Because one of the things the housing boom might have done, in addition to just kind of messing up our interpretation of the labor market in the boom period, is it might have actually slowed down the transition to skill for some of the workers who would have normally accumulated some skills from the declining labor market, from the decline of manufacturing. And in doing so, we might now, and I haven't tested, this is all speculation and there's an exit, we might be left with a generation, 20 to 30-year-olds who grew up in the 2000s, who now enter their 30s and 40s with less skill than they had would have had otherwise. Now, some of those might go back to school and accumulate some skill, but what we know from the literature is that the propensity to go accumulate skill when you're 30 is much lower than it is when you're 20. So we might now, one of the legacies of the housing boom is leaving the economy with a generation of lower skilled individuals than they would have had otherwise. Good news keeps on coming. Okay, let me blah, blah, blah. Let me just tell you three other things quickly and then we'll take some questions. The first is we could explain that wages should be falling. So our counterfactuals are saying we should be seeing wages fall by an additional 3% during the recession. And we haven't seen that yet. So wages are still higher than we're predicting. And there's lots of labor market models, those of you who took my macro class, where we have these sticky wage models where, for whatever reason, wages are downward rigid. And maybe that's going on and that's affecting the labor market as a whole. And that's part of the reason we haven't seen wages fall from the manufacturing decline and the housing correction like we would have predicted. Okay, so that's something we're not doing well in our model. I already told you this. Almost all of the effect is on non-participation. And very little of the effect is on unemployment. So you see the big increase in unemployment rates in the newspaper? We have very little to say about that with the manufacturing decline. What we do explain is the big increase in non-participation that you're hearing about in the newspaper. Our mechanism is trying to explain that. And that's kind of one of the puzzles we've been talking about in macro, is why is non-participation increased in this recession so much more than it has in other recessions? And I think what we're saying is it should have occurred earlier and much more gradually from the decline of manufacturing, but the housing boom masked that. And that's why it's showing up in non-participation. And I've also showed that in the 1990 recession, we find similar effects, but on a smaller scale. Manufacturing was declining in the 80s. You had these localized housing booms on the coast. You see the same type of patterns. The places that had the manufacturing declines and no housing boom showed up with increased unemployment earlier than the places that had declining manufacturing and the housing boom, and then the correction. Okay, so these are conclusions. I already told you these. Structural shifts seem to be having real effects on the economy. About 40% of the increase in non-employment over the decade, about 30% during the recession, is the sum of housing and manufacturing. Labor markets seem to be propped up by the housing boom on the upside. The net effect of housing booms over the decade was small. The boom and the bust were kind of symmetric on labor markets. We tend to focus on the bust. Not a lot of evidence, people talking about the boom. The college education stuff is really, I think, important, and we're going to kind of break that out and create a new paper on that, but I think that's something to think about, as how the housing boom legacy could have been leaving a generation with less skill than they might have had otherwise.